David was born to missionary parents. He grew up in Cambodia, and he and his wife, Becky, have served, well, they served in Gabon for 30 years and raised their family. David is a general surgeon. He has been actively and very integrally involved in the development of the Pan-African Academy of Christian Surgeons, or PACS, that many of you who have served abroad as a surgeon have had the opportunity to work with the PACS residents, who are phenomenal. He continues that work. He and Becky are now serving at Harper Memorial Hospital in Egypt. And so, as I said, he's going to be speaking to us tonight about the future of medical missions. David.
Well, it's a great honor to talk about this topic. And I don't have a prophetic word for you tonight about what's going to happen to medical missions, but I do think that there are trends that we see and needs that we see and changes that are occurring that indicate which direction that we need to take. And I want to share some of the insights that I'm sure many of you have noticed and seen, but that I've seen over the years and that I learned the hard way. As well as things that are also others, even in the secular world, are noticing. Of course, I don't have any. Which way do I point this thing to advance? This way? Next slide. Is it not turned on? Anyway, the next slide says I don't have anything to disclose. The third slide is my references, and there are five of them, but one of them, thank you. Which way should I point it? Any direction?
Anywhere you want.
Okay. So When Healthcare Hurts, that's somewhat similar to the book When Helping Hurts, but it's very much tied into healthcare. It's a very useful book. I would encourage you to get it and look at it. Many of you may have read the second one. The third one is I'll mention a little later on. I had had hoped to have some things from Bruce Steffi's excellent book on Get Ready, Get Set, Go, and he put it in the mail, but I don't know where it went. It never arrived at my address, so I borrowed that. But that is a great reference. And then an article that from the Harvard Public Review, I'll be commenting on that too. I want to start with a story. The war in Eastern Congo began in the early 1990s and is still going on. Some have estimated the death toll at over 5 million people and over 2 million refugees. Congo has abundant natural resources, but according to the UN, it is one of the poorest countries in the world. Providing health care to injured combatants and civilians, women who have been raped, children who are suffering from malaria, pertussis, measles, worms, and even starving has been both dangerous and enormously difficult. During a flare-up in the mid-1990s, a town in eastern Congo that is close to the border with Uganda was spared from the fighting. Tens of thousands of refugees descended on this town, carrying on their backs their belongings. The refugees quickly overwhelmed the chronically understaffed and under-resourced government hospital in the town, so many headed for a modest 50-bed Christian hospital that had been providing medical services to the community for more than 25 years. It, too, was quickly overwhelmed, though it did what it could to help. Local officials appealed to their governments. The governments appealed to the World Health Organization, international relief agencies to provide food, clothing, and emergency medical services. Several well-known relief agencies responded quickly, including a medical NGO that dispatched volunteer doctors and nurses, medical supplies, and tents for a portable hospital. The photo I'm showing you is not the Christian hospital that I mentioned in this story, but it's like that hospital. After a few days of serving refugees who could pay little or nothing for the medical services they received, the Christian hospital ran out of supplies and had no money to purchase more. So when the NGOs arrived in town, everyone, including the Christian hospital, welcomed their coming with gratitude and joy. The medical NGO rented an abandoned building in the town to serve as a pharmacy and an outpatient department, set up a tent for inpatients, a generator, portable water tower. Within a few days, they were able to start treating large numbers of sick and injured refugees. The medical services were free, so the refugees did not complain about the crowding, the long waits, the poor toilet facilities that initially were there, and the very hot tents. Over the next 6 months, the NGO made many improvements and hired locally trained nurses and some doctors. Because the pay scale was higher at the NGO hospital, half of their medical personnel came from the Christian hospital. After a year, many of the refugees returned to their villages and homes, though some decided to settle. The work at the NGO hospital did not decrease significantly because patients from the community naturally took advantage of the free services being offered. For the next 2 years, the NGO continued to improve its hospital and broaden its medical services, but the NGO's kindness and generosity had unintended consequences. 3 years after the NGO hospital opened, the Christian hospital had to close its doors. The hundreds of patients from the community who had previously counted on the hospital's medical services had dwindled to a trickle. Without patients, the hospital could not pay its personnel, so most of the doctors and nurses left and moved to the NGO hospital. The final blow came when the NGO hospital's donors lost interest in the project and one day announced to the community leaders that it would be closing its doors and leaving. The NGO donated its building, equipment, and medicines to the government, which transferred everything of value to a provincial hospital hundreds of kilometers away. It took years for the Christian hospital to restock its pharmacy, hire back the few employees that remained in the community, repair its empty buildings, and clear the weeds and grass that had taken over. But the Christian hospital now faced a new problem. The patients were no longer willing to pay the small pittance that the hospital charged for its services. Patients insisted that their consultations, medicines, and even operations should be provided the way the NGO had provided them, free of charge. They accused the doctors, nurses, and administrators of the Christian hospital of being hard-hearted and uncaring for demanding some payment for their services. It took over a decade in the community to recover. I have three objectives today. The first is to define medical missions, the way that we as Christians and missionaries see it, and describe our changing roles as medical missionaries. The second is to motivate participants, you, to engage in programs that empower local healthcare workers and equip them to provide not a low level of medical care and healthcare, but a high level of healthcare to their communities. And finally, to motivate participants to highly value small beginnings. And why is that part of the future of medical missions? The reason is that if today you do not engage in the dreams God is putting in your heart for future medical paradigms and medical work, 20 years from now, they won't be here. Small beginnings are extremely important to the future of medical missions, and we'll talk about that and how difficult they are. Zechariah 4:10, you should know quite well, "Do not despise these small beginnings, for the Lord rejoices to see the work begin." How do we define medical missions? Is it medical work overseas? Well, the atheists and the agnostics, Buddhist, Hindus, and Muslim missionaries, they do that too. Is it medical work overseas at a mission hospital, a Christian hospital? Well, short-term physicians have been doing that for decades. Well, what about the long-term medical work overseas at a Christian or a mission hospital? You know, agnostic doctors who want to leave a legacy are clamoring to do that. So my definition is very simple. Medical missions, as we define it, is bringing love, healthcare, and Jesus to people who do not have them. Love, healthcare, and Jesus. Now, that is not a priority listing. That's the order in which we bring it. Love, because this is God's motivation in sending us to wherever we go to tell people about Christ, to help them with their sicknesses. Healthcare, because Jesus commanded us to follow his example and heal the sick as a tangible expression of God's love and of our love for people who suffer. And Jesus, because he is the world's only Savior and he is our coming King. Now, that's very easy to say, but it's much harder to do. When we first arrived in Bongolo, in Gabon, as missionaries, we did not want to be there. We actually wanted to be somewhere else. I mean, we had signed up for this great mission experience, a lifetime experience, and we had envisioned what that was going to be like. We were going to go to Asia, where we grew up. She grew up in Vietnam. I grew up in Cambodia. We went to the mission school together, and it was just going to be peachy. Well, that didn't work out. Vietnam fell to the communists before we could get there. Cambodia fell to the Khmer Rouge before we could get there. And our mission said, we don't have any other work left, but we do have some work in Africa. There's two places, Congo and Gabon. Well, we had no idea where either of those were. We did not want to go to Africa. All the missionaries I'd met who came from Africa were just plain weird. And so I did not want to become like them. Well, we prayed and prayed, and we knew that God was calling us, and finally it was like, all right, okay, Lord, we get the message, and off we went to Gabon. But in my heart, I had not bought into this, and I did not like the people. I did not like the culture. I did not like the food. I did not want to be there deep in my heart, although I would not say that to anyone. Well, when we arrived, we discovered epidemics of measles, malaria. Everybody had malaria. All the kids had malaria. Adults did too. They just kept having episodes of it. Pertussis and polio. And that year, thousands of children died in our province. Many of them in our miserable dispensary. That's all there was. We had nothing to help them with. And when we saw the anguish of those mothers, it broke my heart. It broke our hearts. And we could not help but love them. God has his ways of changing our hearts and teaching us to love the people that we serve. And I want to talk, I'll come back to this subject again about what God calls us to do. It is never what we envisioned, but it is what God has created us to do and designed us to do. It is not, however, enough to love, to heal, and to share Jesus until you drop. There is something else that we must do as we are doing these things, as we are bringing love, healthcare, and Jesus to people. The future of medical missions depends on the willingness of us, all of us, Christian medical professionals, to make disciples who will love, who will heal, and who will share Jesus. That is the future, if there is going to be a future for medical missions. Michelle Morse, writing in the Harvard Public Health Review, which I listed in my references, about some of the American university efforts to engage globally, and that she has witnessed, wrote, "Too many of these programs verge on neocolonialism. The priority placed on student experiences results in medical mission-style trips in which trainees with inadequate skills visit a developing country site for a few weeks and usurp resources. That could be better directed towards local personnel who are more interested in long-term outcomes." It's not just me and other missionaries who are saying this. This is also coming from a secular medical field in the United States, many universities. You know, no matter how smart you are, how prepared you are, and how determined you are to change the healthcare of a community or of a country or whatever it is that God has called you to try and do, you will not significantly change the plight of the poor without equipping them and enlisting them to help themselves. I know that many of you know these things, but I just want to reiterate them to you. I was very slow in learning this, and I'll tell you a little bit my story in a few minutes. This is very different from trying to save the world and leading patients to faith by yourself. We naturally focus on suffering people, and our instincts as medical professionals are to plunge in and to just save everybody. When we fail and some of our patients die, it doesn't matter if we've saved 300 of them, we are crushed by our failure. If we continue down this road, we will eventually burn out and disappear. Before we can make disciples capable of taking our place. Tackling the problems you face with boundless energy and determination is not the solution to the problems you will face. Making disciples who can help you do that is the solution. This is what Jesus showed us. He chose 12 people, and for 3 years he poured himself into them. There were others who listened, there were others who participated, but he focused on those 12 people. This is what he commanded us to do in the Great Commission, to make disciples of all nations. Now, making disciples who are willing to do more than just provide the world standard of secular health care requires that we do some things that we are not trained to do in medical school or in residency, such as praying for patients to be healed. If you are a believer, you have the power of Jesus to pray for the healing of your patients, even to cast out demons. Don't throw away that power just because secular psychiatry turns its nose up at it. You know, you may never have a ministry of casting out demons in people, but the day will come, I predict, especially if you serve in Asia or Africa and not in a Western country or a highly developed country, the day will come when you will be faced with a patient who is clearly challenging you because you are a follower of Christ and there's a demon in that patient. It might be a violent patient. Don't throw away the power of Jesus to say, in the name of Jesus, I command you to stop. And then call the pastor and others to come and deal with that patient. It's happened to me many times. Praying for a patient is so powerful. The only way that I can explain it, I've seen it happen again and again as I moved up into Egypt, where we can't talk to our patients about Christ. We can't give them a tract. We can't do anything without getting their families angry or them angry. But when I pray for my patients, when I pray for them, Jesus comes into the room. You can just sense, they sense it. It's just unbelievable. I mean, I've seen patients as I sit, can I pray for you? And this, first of all, there's confusion. You're a doctor, and you're not a priest. How are you going to pray? And they think I'm going to get down and put my head on the floor like they do, you know. And the resident, I have my resident who's translating because I'm still terrible in Arabic, says, the doctor's going to ask Allah to help you and heal you and just protect you and give us wisdom. And it's like, oh, okay. And so then we just pray a very simple prayer. Lord, help this patient, take away his pain and suffering and anxiety, and help him to know that you love him, you know everything about him, and be there with us in the operating room. In Jesus' name, amen. I've opened my eyes and seen patients, Muslims, with tears in their eyes. I've prayed a blessing on them. It brings Jesus into the room. A great way to open the door for a deeper relationship with a patient is to pray with him. Now, obviously, we can't pray with every patient. You might have 50 patients outside, and if you pray with every patient, the last 20 of them are going to lynch you. But you can ask God to tell you which patients, and if the thought comes to your mind, that's the patient you're to pray for. It's happened to me many times. Something else that is not part of secular medicine is mentoring those that we are training, that we are working with. You know, we think we're just working with these nurses or these medical students or whatever, but we're their example. And we need to see it that we are training them, we are teaching and mentoring them. For example, how do you respond to a patient who shouts at you because you're not working fast enough? How do you respond to a critically ill patient who arrives at 2 a.m. when you know that at 8 a.m. you have to be up and working an 8-hour day at the hospital? How do you respond to dying patients or to patients you cannot possibly help? Do you, what do you do with those patients? Is there the love of Christ demonstrated in your life in those situations? This is mentoring the Word of God. This is showing how it's practiced. Sharing our medical knowledge, our spiritual knowledge, our skills, our vision, and our wisdom with the healthcare workers we work with every day is a huge gift to them. When our disciples are ready, we need to empower them to lead. I can tell you that this is very hard to do because you can always do it better than your student. You can always do it better than the person that you have trained. But when the day comes that you sense that they know how to do 75% of what you do or even 60% of what you do, maybe that's the time to say, okay, I'm going to put you in charge and I'm going to be your assistant. Very difficult to do. But you know, this is how we empower people and get them to take leadership. God has not called us to make followers of men. He has called us to make followers of Him who become leaders. Let me look at something very practical now. I'll shift gears just a bit. Small beginnings. I want to talk about small beginnings. Small beginnings can become great works of God. I've been involved in two of them, and I am just astonished that it could actually happen with me. For these works of God to last, we must empower the people we work with. Now, I began as a child growing up in Cambodia, and if you look on the map there in eastern Cambodia, east of that big lake over towards the border, that's where I grew up, where my parents worked with the tribal people there. There was this doctor named Tom Dooley who had been a Navy doctor, and he had started working in Vietnam with people in villages who had no health care. And eventually, when he got out of the Navy, he came back. He was Catholic and had just really had a heart of compassion. And he came back, and he made this organization called Medico. And one of the hospitals, he would open up government hospitals that had been closed because there were no personnel. And he would get personnel, volunteers from all over the world. I mean, there were Egyptians, there were Greeks, there were Russians, and they were all on the same team. It was pretty wild stuff. And we had one in our town. So I met Tom Dooley. We had dinner with him several times. And it was really, for me, the first time I started thinking about medicine. But Tom Dooley developed melanoma, metastatic melanoma, and he died in his late 30s. When he died, the whole organization collapsed because he had not empowered anybody else to help him. I didn't know that till much later. Now, when I was 14, that's when I saw my father and I were, our family was traveling, and there was a terrible accident along the road, and we tried to help a man who had a crushed chest, and we couldn't. And I was just so traumatized when this man died that I just, for weeks and weeks, I was just praying about that and knowing that this Buddhist man had not gone to heaven. And if only we could have helped him, he would have had a chance. He would have heard the gospel. He could have made a decision. Just those thoughts went through my mind. And that I began praying that I could become a missionary doctor. I could help people who were sick and dying and give them the opportunity to hear about Christ. And so that was my beginning. And many other things happened. Many other people got involved. When I applied for medical school, the guy who interviewed me was the head of pediatric surgery at Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh. And at the time, he was the chief of the Pediatric Surgical Society of the United States. And he didn't tell me he was a believer. And when I read my, you know, he had my essay in front of him where I said I wanted to be a medical missionary. And he says, oh, so he said, you're going to tell people about Jesus. And I said, yeah, that's right. He said, so what if they don't want to hear about it? Oh, well, you know, I won't force it on them. And you know, it's just, and he went on, that line of questioning, you know, just difficult question. Where are your parents? What do they think about you becoming a medical missionary? I did not want to get into that. My parents were killed in 1968. They were martyred in Vietnam, and that was a whole other thing. And I did not want to talk about that with him because, but he said, you know, I said, well, they're very happy about me. But he wasn't finished. He said, so where are your parents? And I said, well, my parents are in heaven. And then the whole story came out. But, you know, this man said, I will do everything in my power to get you into this medical school. And not only that, but, you know, he talk about a small beginning. He said, you can come and live in my house with me and my family. And then he got in touch with an organization that was supporting medical students who wanted to be medical missionaries. It was before MedSend, a very small group in Philadelphia, and they paid all of my tuition. I graduated from medical school debt-free. The role of faith is so important to God. To small beginnings. You see, when God calls us to do something, He gives us an idea that's about this big, you know, and you think, wow, that's really going to be tough, Lord. But, I can do that. But really, you know, and then as soon as you start, it just starts to grow. But if He told us ahead of time, we would never accept it. Small, God knows what we can handle. But He gives us these dreams. And many of the times, it's impossible. What He is proposing, it seems impossible. That's where we have to be walking by faith. If there is going to be a future to medical missions, God plans to do more. God plans to do more, far more in and through you than you can possibly imagine, even in your wildest dreams. This is me in my Becky in 1975. That just proves that God can use people who wear bad clothes. Actually, that was a gift from my mother-in-law. I had to wear that coat. But, God's dreams for us are far greater than anything, and many of you can attest to that. I know many of you have experienced this too. So when God did call us to go to Gabon, we arrived in the capital city. First of all, we had to find out where Gabon was, and that's where it was. And then they told us, well, when we got there, they said, you're going to be down in the south, the extreme south, away from the capital city. And we said, okay, that, you know, must be a good reason for that. They're probably, they said, well, there's, you know, healthcare down there. That's one thing. That was a good reason. They said, we have a dispensary down there where, you know, a missionary nurse was working. And so we started down this on this trip, and the road was paved. It looked really nice. And we thought, this country of Gabon, you know, this is pretty well developed. There were some scary things on the way, and we were a little more worried about it then. And then the asphalt ran out, and it rains 10 feet a year in Gabon. And when it rains, this is what happens to the roads. We saw accidents along the way, and then we came to these bridges that got more and more interesting. Finally, the road was looking like this, and deep in our hearts, there was confusion. It's like, you know, this looks like we're going out to a little jungle clearing. That couldn't be, because we're important. I mean, we're highly trained. And if there are only a few people, why, that would be a waste. And so we kept going until we came to the end of the road. I mean, it actually ended. And they put us on this raft and took us, and then we were there. Well, the next day they said, we want to take you to show you where you will be working. And it was just pitiful. Here was this dispensary, no water, no electricity, no ceilings, no plaster on the inside. There was mud brick, you know, it came off and when you touched it. There were 100 goats who slept in the courtyard and around it every night, and they pooped everywhere. You could not get in without walking on it. Then it dried on the floors, and they would sweep it up, and it would come up and cover everything. So I said, we're doing no surgery till we get rid of the goats. So I spent the first year killing goats. So it's just, you never know what God is going to get you into. This is why you need faith for small beginnings. God gave me a wonderful spouse and a wonderful team. It was Becky who had the idea to start a nursing school. She opened a laboratory as well. She just was very willing to do whatever needed to be done. And that nursing school quickly provided trained and discipled personnel that allowed us to expand our services. Not only that, it gave ownership to the project because the children of the community were working in the hospital, and they were getting paid. And she continued that nursing school until we left, and it just allowed the hospital to keep growing. It was a huge blessing. These were not things that we thought of, or I thought of at the time, but as the project expanded, God was showing us what to do. After 17 years, you've seen this slide before, this is what the hospital looked like. It was we had become the major referral center for the southern two provinces of the country, about 200,000 people. But as you can predict, I was totally overwhelmed. I could not operate any more than I was operating. I was the only surgeon at the hospital. We had some other doctors there. And so I began to ask God, where can we find some help? And what I found out was really appalling. Most African countries, including Gabon, had no formal surgical training programs. The ratio of surgeons to people was between 1 to 250,000 to 1 to 2 million, fewer than 20% of the women who needed C-sections could get them. These are just appalling statistics. Fewer than 20% of men who needed hernias could get them repaired. Outside of our hospital and the capital city, the mortality for a strangulated hernia was 90%. The majority of femur fractures were treated with prolonged bed rest without traction, leaving patients with permanent deformities. Children with femur fractures were crippled for life. And the probability of death at age 0 to 15 was 22% compared to 1.1% in developed countries. You know, it just gets worse. 5% of African surgeons serving in rural areas. 10% of adult deaths can be prevented. 20% of pediatric deaths can be prevented by surgical intervention. So, you know, the surgical realities just got worse and worse as this went on. And I said, you know, to the Lord, you know, what should I do? I can't go on like this. I don't have time to be with my children. I'm working 120 hours a week. I'm going to burn out. And I was very surprised at the Lord's answer. He said, "You train them." I was praying, and that thought came to my mind, and I said, "What a random thought." You know? And when that passed, I prayed some more, and the Lord said, "You train them." And I said, "Well, that's enough prayer for today." And but week after week, I kept getting the same answer. And so, but it was impossible. I'm not the academic type, and others are more qualified. I thought, nobody, who's going to apply to something like this? And the government will shut us down. We're not a university hospital. My family will suffer. I'll die of exhaustion. You know, God should find someone more qualified. What do you do in that situation? Well, God gave an idea. He didn't just tell me to train them. He then gave me an idea. It didn't come to me like that. Just little by little, it started to come to me. And that if we had one board-certified surgeon per mission hospital, 5 to 10 visiting surgeons per year, donations to support the residents, 5-year formal training program based in U.S. model, and we trained residents at multiple hospitals across Africa. In 20 years, we could train enough surgeons to make a difference for the entire continent. So I took the idea to Brackenhurst, some of you know what that is, and presented that to them, and there were 10 of us who got together and said, "Let's do this. Let's do this." And we created the Pan-African Academy of Christian Surgeons, and you know the rest. Today, 18 years after we began, we have training programs in all these countries here. We have currently 60-some residents. We'll have 74 residents in January, or 70. Bruce Steffes can give you the exact number. And I got my life back. Once I had residents, within 2 years, I got my life back, and it just got better and better. So this was our hospital when we left it, and God asked us, this slide is outdated. It's about 3 or 4 years old, but this is back then. This is where our graduates were serving all over Africa. We have more now serving in more places. So, you know, when healthcare, one of the references I gave you It is essential that we realize that using strictly vertical approaches to healthcare delivery and resource poor communities can be more harmful than helpful. This is especially true if those projects are separated from local healthcare professionals and their services. I really want to encourage you to think big, bigger than just I'm going to work tomorrow in the pediatrics clinic or the and to see 100 patients. There's much more that is in my notes, and I'm not going to have time to cover all that. I want to leave time for questions. Let me just conclude this. What is the future for medical missions as we define it? We must follow Jesus wherever he calls us to serve, not where we want to serve. We must be willing to use our skills, our knowledge, our passion, our faith to heal the sick and love our patients. We must have Christ's passion to bring people to faith in Jesus. We have to proclaim the gospel. It's not enough simply to be the gospel. We must also speak the gospel for people to come to believe. And that's part of what sets us apart from secular medical missions. So what is the future? We must make every healing experience a teaching experience. Our priority must be to develop Christian leaders who will be capable of taking our places. We must step aside when that happens and let them lead. Very hard to do. They'll make mistakes. They'll make awful mistakes. But that's also what we did when we came, right? We've just conveniently forgotten those things. So our priority must be to develop Christian leaders in the field of medicine as we are serving. Make failure your teacher. I failed many times. I failed as a new missionary to love the people. God taught me that. I failed to keep up with the surgical demands. That was how PAX came about. Not doing the work alone, but doing and teaching to others the work of caring for sick people in all of its permutations, loving them and sharing Christ with them. So I want to leave time for a few questions, and please just think about that for a moment before you ask them. Yes. You know, we have had very little political opposition because we have been training the nationals of that country to be good surgeons. It's interesting that in Gabon, the government has never only recognized the hospital about a month ago, after 35 years or since 1977. It finally recognized the hospital. It's been giving money, it's been, you know, doing many things to help the hospital. Now for the residency program, the big problem is that they only have a university paradigm for teaching. They don't have community hospital specialty training. It's not even in their brains. They just can't conceive of it. And so that's a hang up in several countries. But we have not seen governments come after us. The one exception might be in Ethiopia, where the governments have said you cannot exclude Muslims from the training program. And in Egypt, we can't either. But everybody knows no Muslim's going to come to a Christian hospital to train. In Ethiopia, it might be a little different. But there we've had to be very careful and change some things. We have ways of only accepting Christians. But on the surface, we can't say that we will only accept Christians.
If we could go ahead and repeat the question so that everyone can hear it.
Yes, that was about government opposition. Very minimal. Even in Egypt, very minimal. None that I know of. Yes. Yes. Sounds familiar.
Yeah,
oh. Things have gotten a little more sophisticated now. We put them in Ziploc bags. Oh. Yes. Very slowly is about all I can tell you. I think you have to be intentional, and it really helps to have people come over from the States short-term and work with your accountant and the director of the hospital and explain budgets, and it has to be done a number of times. If you can also send them, if you can send administrators to learn hospital administration or some courses in accounting, it's amazing the transformation. Once they've, you know, they themselves have had these courses, their thinking about it changes. But hearing it from us sometimes is not the best way. Yes. How do we learn what?
Learn how to be a good teacher.
Good teacher. Other than trial and error, how do you learn to be a good teacher? I think reading some good books about it is very helpful. And if there's somebody who can come and mentor you, you have short-term people, you could invite somebody to come and show you how to teach. But I would say that it mainly comes from the heart. Do you really want to see this person know what you know? And if that is your goal, you'll find a way to teach them. And I trained nurses who had sixth grade education to be a nurse anesthetist. It was very scary, believe me. But we did it. And so you really, if you're determined, you can eventually. It may take a long time, though. Yeah, the question is, do we have a formal discipleship program? And the answer is yes. We have one book every year that's put together by Stan Key and his team, and it's just a very good course. The whole thing of Bible studies, it's like 20 lessons, and we go through it in a year. Some of the lessons take 2 weeks, two different sessions. And every week we meet for 90 minutes, at least at our hospital, for Bible study. And Becky does the spouses. Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.